this is Julianne Good, and you're listening to Psych 101. We're here to make psychology understandable, interesting, hopefully entertaining, and give you some tips for better living. Today, my show is on anxiety and depression. This is one of those things that a lot of us are going through right now. It's just busy pace on most of our lives. And hopefully this is going to give you some information that's going to make it a little bit easier to manage if you're going through anxiety and depression, or if anybody that you know is going through this. So this is kind of the common cold of our society right now, right? So anyways, my guest today is Wayne Brazil, MFT, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about his background. He has a private practice as the clinical director of G. Wayne Brazil and Associates, family counselors and consultants, and is a partner and clinical supervisor of Pacific Coast Psychological Associates, a large private practice in Fullerton, California. He teaches psychopharmacology at Hope International University in Fullerton, in addition to conducting an active personal practice. He also serves on the board of directors of A Quarter Blue, which is an organization which is dedicated to serving survivors of childhood abuse and molestation. He is an artist, a poet, a musician, and a very successful businessman. Welcome, Wayne.
Thank you very much. It's really nice to hear from you today.
You too. My first question for you is, do you think that anxiety and depression are the common cold of psychology?
Well, certainly, and it is my experience that anxiety is really at the basis of most things I see in my office. Even depression seems to have its roots in anxiety, and maybe that's the human condition, as I say. Since we lived in the caves and we were beating off the cave bear and grubbing for food in the ground and surviving cold and weather, and the elements, we've been anxious. We are an anxious culture, an anxious society. We are anxious people.
So what differentiates being anxious and just having a nice, normal level of adrenaline to keep you going and to keep you on your toes?
Well, certainly anxiety does serve a purpose, doesn't it? Really, when we're anxious, it tells us something is wrong. Something needs to change. Something is happening. I wonder what that is. But of course, we do recognize that there are people who suffer from anxiety as a clinical way, without any. When we don't have a cave bear chasing us, or we've just lost our job, or we can't pay our bills, or our life is out of control. We just feel that regular adrenaline kind of overwhelming our ability to cope. Now that can happen because there's a little structure back on the brainstem called the locus coeruleus that sends signals down into the adrenals, which are on top of the kidneys, and produces a lot of adrenaline. And that produces a flood of adrenaline into the limbic system of the brain and stimulates the production of a lot of dopamine. The problem is that dopamine normally is moderated by another chemical in our frontal lobe called serotonin, which is supposed to cause us to take a look at what's going on in our lives and say, oh, this is not so bad, or, oh, this is only temporary, I can get over this, and or this, if I do this and this and I can solve that problem, I won't feel this way anymore. But when it comes in such a really high quantity, quite often the process circumvents the frontal lobe's activity and floods our brain with dopamine and as a consequence produces more adrenaline. So what we end up doing is getting anxious and more anxious, and pretty soon we're afraid of being afraid, and it just is completely overwhelming. And when we get that way, we really don't know how to cope. It just overwhelms us.
Right, and then it puts us into overdrive, and it gets us edgy and angry and fighting with other people and just living on a short fuse. Would you agree?
Right, and that's what happens. And, for us, a lot of people I see so many kids today that are very, very anxious, young people. About half my practice are in adolescence. And I see them so anxious today. Where is that from? What's this about? And what we do, of course, with kids when they become depressed or anxious, we get them out of bed and send them to school, where they behave there when they act out their feelings, and rather because they don't have vocabulary to say, gee, really, I can't go to school today because I really am just too overwhelmed to go to school. If I'm too overwhelmed, I go to bed. I shut off the phone. I quit talking to people.
Right, or else they start manifesting physical problems like stomach aches and headaches and, you know, and instead of being able to go to the direct psychological cause of what's getting them to feel like that, they're getting a lot of messages from the adults is like going, okay, get with it. You're a kid. You shouldn't be feeling like this. You have nothing to worry about, right?
Yeah, what could be your problem? Because you don't have the problems I have. Quite often we do that. We value things in terms of how much I'm hurting or how much I'm scared. You can't be scared. I'll show you scared. This is scared.
Right. So we minimize children and just tell them they should be going on their way and forget about it and sweep it under the rug. Yes.
Of course. And the problem is with anxiety is not only does it produce an overwhelming chemical reaction in our brain, then it begins to kick off some other chemicals in our body called cortisol, which is the body's natural cortisone, which is really, really powerfully important for us because it's the cortisol that brings healing to a cut or to a wound or to a broken bone. That's what helps us heal. But when that is not, when there is no cut and there is no actual injury, what the cortisol does is begin to store up in the fat cells of our body. So it begins to go to work on and actually gobble up muscle tissue, especially those muscles that make up the heart, the diaphragm, and other kinds of organs like that. And it really can produce sickness in us. We become ill.
So long term, all that gobbling up of those muscle cells, what can that do with a person that's under constant anxiety and stress?
Well, and of course, what we see is people under a lot of stress, they get ulcers, which is we know now as H. pylori, a bacteria in the stomach. But our body becomes incapable of overwhelming and overcoming those kinds of natural opportunistic viruses and bacteria that are floating around in the air and in our body all the time. And so we become ill. And, of course, the ultimate is that we end up with stroke and heart attack.
And that is probably one of the most major number one illnesses in this country is heart disease, correct?
Oh, totally, totally, right. And you know, we say, well, you can't live that kind of a stressful life and so on and so on. Yeah, but there are people, you know, who have learned to handle their stresses easier than others. And basically kind of, oh, well, no problem, attitude. But that's not true for most of us.
And that we'll get into a little bit later on tips on how to manage stress and anxiety and depression. Now, on the other end of the coin is depression. So what does that look like when it's coupled up with anxiety? Or is it kind of a flip-flop situation for a lot of people?
Well, for most people, I think it is. In fact, I say if I'm running around on the surface of my life trying to solve my problems and I lose my job and I can't pay my bills and my family is coming apart, my children are misbehaving and getting kicked out of school and I've got an oppositional defiant child and so forth. I've got all these kinds of social problems out there and I can't solve them. I'm going to become highly anxious. That's what that's going to do is cause me to drop into a pit of depression. At the bottom of that pit, it kind of forks out in several different ways. It can fork out into real illness. And we get real illnesses from these kinds of depression and anxiety syndromes. We get asthma. We get migraine. We get heart disease. We get kidney disease. We get liver disease. These things actually can have their etiology or their genesis in these kinds of emotional responses.
Right.
The other thing that it splits off into, it can split off into rage. My depression can become rage. I can express my depression and my anxiety by being angry at people, but not just outraged. Outraged is when we're really angry at something that deserves my anger, you know. The divorce rate in America is huge, you know. There are issues, social issues in our culture that are just huge, and we need to be outraged about those. There are people who are cutting the arms off of children because they're not of the same tribe they are in Africa. I mean, that's outrageous.
It is.
That's not the problem. The problem is when we become enraged. When the depression, my inability to handle my depression and my anxiety, I become enraged. And the enraged, in other words, it's turned inwards, actually results in going into my workplace and shooting people up or running somebody off the road because they passed me on the wrong side or cut me off, or my child responded to me in a way I didn't think they should, so I lashed out at them in anger and I became enraged at them. Now that's really, really dangerous.
It is. It's you're out of control. You're not thinking clearly at all, and we are seeing more and more incidents of people becoming enraged and mass shooting people. I'm appalled by how many incidents of mass shootings we have had over the last year. That should be a wake-up call.
Yeah, and we'd like to say that these people are bipolar and psychotic and schizophrenics and things like that. You know, that's true, I guess, in some cases, but not in all cases. That there are many cases in which it's just I've had all I can take of this, and I'm not going to take it anymore, and the only thing that seems possible for me to do is to go out and hurt somebody or hurt myself.
Right, instead of doing preventative self-care. And
right.
we're not going out as a society enough and saying, you know, if you get these warning signs, you need to go get some help, or you need to go get some social support. You need to take care of yourself instead of taking it out on other people before it gets to that point where you're going to be running somebody off the road or picking up a gun and shooting somebody. It's, you know, there's got to be a point where we're doing more preventative care in this country. Would you agree?
I would agree. I totally agree. And quite often what we do is we get into contact with somebody who's outraged or enraged, and we don't disengage from them. We need to learn to not be reactive to people in our lives. I tell couples and I tell individuals the same thing. If I could teach you anything, and that was simply don't be reactive.
Right, and that's what I do with the children that I counsel. And because
totally.
Bullying is a big problem right now,
totally.
One of my recommendations to them is saying one or two words to sit there and say, you know, I'm not going to sit there and take this kind of behavior from you, and then turning around and walking away, but looking over their shoulders to make sure that that person's not going to be running after them. But
right.
It's you have to learn that coping mechanism. You need to say one or two words and walk away and let that person just simmer down on his or her own.
Oh, sure. And that happens with couples and so on and so on. And, of course, if the person who becomes enraged could just recognize, first of all, that this is just an expression of the anxiety that they're feeling because they're feeling out of control, or they're feeling phobic about something, or something really scared them. You know, we in our culture have learned that there's an acceptable feeling. You know, if you yell at me, I'll lash out at you. If you treat me unfairly, I will hurt you. You watch the TV shows, and it's constantly this negative lashing out, hurtful things. And we all laugh and say, oh, gee, that's funny. No, that's not funny to me.
No.
That's not funny to me. I say if everybody's not laughing, it's not funny.
Right, and it's amazing how many more crime shows are coming out every season.
Totally.
So it's almost like the media is feeding into this. So,
well, and it's like I say, it's a part of our culture. You know, if you don't like the woman you're with, you just simply lash out at her and leave her. What? Really? Is that the kind of culture we want to have? When do I start walking off from my children? Is that what I really want to produce? Is that what I want to do? I don't think so.
Exactly. Now, can you tell us some of the signs of when adrenaline turns into anxiety and then becomes problematic?
Well, you know, any time that I'm beginning to feel out of control, I've got to stop and say to myself, wait a minute, what? I always think that there's a part of me, okay, all of me, but there's a part of me that feels out of control. That there's a part of me that feels out of control. Not all of me, but a part of me. And if I can get to listening to that part to find out what that part needs and wants from me at that moment, I'll certainly be a whole lot better off.
So in other words, just stop for a moment and question what your actions and your feelings are in that
sure.
moment.
Yeah, my view of most all, you know, first of all, that there's a whole bunch of emotional issues that are designated as problems by the psychiatric and psychological field. You know, we say people are phobic. Well, wait a minute, that's anxiety. Well, they have eating disorders. No, that's an anxiety. They're addicted. I'm telling you what, addictions are, every one of them, anxiety-driven. I cannot deal with my life without this pill. I cannot deal with my life without this drink, without this drug. You know, all those numbers of things that we have thought about as being separate are really anxiety-based. I was talking to somebody about hoarding the other day. They said, well, they'll get somebody in there and help that person get organized. And I'm saying, I don't care how many times you send somebody in there to organize them. In a week or two, they'll be disorganized again because the issue is not their organizational skills. Their issue is, without my stuff, I am out of control. Without my things, who am I? It's anxiety.
And a major attachment issue also, long-standing, yes.
All that attachment stuff is all anxiety-driven. The ideology, the genesis of it, is in our inability to solve our life problems.
So what would you recommend then for some of the ways for coping with anxiety once you can tap into, you know, getting to the point where it's like, okay, this is in good stress. This is, you know, to the point that I need to do something about this because, first of all, I'm affecting myself. I'm feeling rotten and I'm making everyone else around me feel bad too. So what can people start doing besides slowing down, questioning their behavior, maybe doing some slow, deep breathing?
Well, all of that really is helpful, and all that's designed to do is to simply give yourself some time to do the deep breathing. It's just a matter of putting some distance between you and the event. I like to teach people a couple of things. One is that is to be more curious, more interested in what's going on inside themselves. I call that taking a bio slice through oneself. So that what you do is you look inside yourself and say, gee, this is interesting. I'm feeling angry right now. Now, where did that come from and what does that mean? Why do I choose anger as a way to express what's going on with me? You know, if I can do that, I can begin to understand myself a little better. Okay, so once I understand, gee, this is interesting, isn't this curious, I'm feeling this way, then I can say to myself, what do I want right now? And if I did what I wanted, what would that produce? What would be the result? Would that produce something good, or would it produce something bad? Would it exacerbate the problem, or would it solve the problem?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to get a little bit out of my feelings. I say our feelings sometimes lie to us. If I moved on my feelings all the time, you know, I would sleep with a lady down the street, even though I'm married, you know. If I went on my feelings all the time, I would be spending all my money on chocolate because, after all, I'm a chocoholic. So, you know, what I'm saying is we've got to absolutely question what we feel.
Yeah.
If we can do that, I think we've got a chance then to controlling how we act. The other thing is I try to teach people that, you know, it's like I've got a styrofoam cup here, and I look at that styrofoam cup in terms of every bit of the energy I've got in my whole lifetime to pour out into my world as far as anger is concerned is in this cup. That's all I have. There's no more. and I have just taken half of that cup and dumped it out regarding a guy who pulled over on me in the freeway as though, at my deathbed, I'm going to say I really should have run that guy down and hurt him. Really? Yeah. Are you kidding me?
Right. What's the sense of that? And also, I think, too, the natural response after having an anger response to somebody, especially if it's really overblown and you're screaming and swearing and everything else,
sure,
is you're trained afterwards. I mean, I know when I become angry to that point, luckily not too often anymore, but it still happens, you know.
Sure.
But I'm just drained afterwards, and I'm like going, why did I do that? You know, I really think I could have handled that much better. And then you go back and you apologize to the person, and then you're explaining, and it's just like, why couldn't I have done that explanation up front and saved all that negativity?
Sure, and it's like I say, if we would be able to say to ourselves, wait a minute, what is it I'm feeling right now? I'm feeling enraged. I really want to lash out and hurt this person. Is that really what I want? No, this person just scared me. Maybe what I really need to do is say, what you just did frightened me, or what you just did frustrated me.
Yeah.
Or what you just did made me feel sad.
Right. Call it what it is.
If I can say those kinds of things, then I can say to myself, wait a minute, what do I want? Do I want to just be just blow off at them and be enraged at them and things like that? No, I've only got so much of that energy around for me to use, and I want to save it for real injustices in this world. I want to save my rage for if somebody molests my grandchild.
Yeah, definitely put it towards more positive ways of dealing with life and putting that energy into it, because it requires an incredible amount of energy to have a fit.
Totally. Think of the energy it takes to be mad at somebody and the total energy that it takes to do road rage things. You know, why?
Yeah, and then how many people can you endanger in the meantime?
Oh, of course, here's my problem with it. The guy that pulled on me in the freeway, you know, a week from now, 6 months from now, a year from now, I won't even remember him. He will disappear into all of those people who have pulled over me in the freeway.
Yeah, hopefully, and hopefully he or she won't be pulling a gun on you on the freeway, too.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, and I'm not going to be popping off at my boss because somebody pulled over on me in the freeway. I'm going to make sure that my anger stays focused on where it belongs.
And move
not
it through.
Not just free reign out in the world. I'm not running around casting my rage around in the world and that anger.
Right.
You know, that I'm going to recognize that when I became anxious, I acted out in an angry way. I sometimes think that the anger is the shell, is the covering on other more gentle, tender feelings. When I'm feeling anxious, you may get my anger. Why? Why don't I just say, I'm really feeling afraid right now?
Yeah.
Because, well, in our culture, of course, it's not okay to be afraid.
Especially if you're a man. Right.
I'm the WWE psychologist, you know. You can't scare me. I'm a big guy. I will hurt you. Yeah, really? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Yeah, what is so bad about saying I'm anxious or I'm afraid?
Exactly.
I clearly admit it, boy. I'll tell you what, there are things that absolutely scare me to death. You know, one of them is I'm not afraid of heights. I'm afraid of falling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I was born in the high Sierras. I'm sure that every time I went on the back porch, somebody yelled at me, don't go out there, you will fall.
Right, and then it becomes ingrained in your memory.
Totally.
And then every time you go to that mountain edge, better watch out what that next step is.
Yeah. In my family, one was rage, and the other was guilt. And we ran back and forth between raging at people and feeling guilty about it, raging at people and feeling guilty about it. Man, there's a whole range of feelings that are available to me besides rage and guilt.
Right. So I think people just need to become more aware and better in tuned with mm-hmm. what they are feeling at the very moment.
Sure.
I think a lot of us get so busy that we just disconnect from what we're totally feeling in the moment, or we're overthinking things. There's the other side of the coin. We're either feeling too much and putting too much emphasis on I want what I want and I want it now, or then we overthink things and go, oh, you know, I'm feeling something inside, but I can't name it, so therefore I'm going to just push it down and just...
Sure. I want it, I want it now, and I deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got it. What, really? That, you know, I don't just deserve things because I decided I wanted them. You know, if I got what I deserved, oh my gosh, that'd be pretty bad.
Yeah, that would be an interesting world if everybody got their own way, right? I mean,
really,
nobody would be working with anybody. It would just be the kingdom of me.
That's right. Yeah, all right. You know, I always say, if I could live life perfectly, you'd be worshiping in the Church of Wayne. You know, I'm not a perfect human being.
None of us are.
I'm a flawed person. I live in a broken world.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said to me the other day, well, this whole idea is that we're going to make this perfect world, where you just keep working at it and the world would become perfect. Listen, the world is not going to become perfect. It is broken.
Mm-hmm.
My best thing that I can do is to be as much help to other broken people in this world as I possibly can. It's the reason I'm in this field.
Right, me too.
I don't come into this field as a perfect person. I come into this world as a broken human being. Today's my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday. That's awesome.
30 years clean and sober today.
Ah, that's awesome. Good for you.
Yeah. It's not my physical birthday, but it certainly is my spiritual, emotional birthday.
Yeah, your sobriety birthday. That's wonderful.
Sobriety birthday
is incredible.
The best, yeah.
Yes.
And I recognize that when we were talking about anxiety and depression, that anxiety drove my alcoholism. That depression drove my alcoholism. I mean, you know, when I was 38 years old, I had a girlfriend. I thought she was the best thing that ever happened to me, the most wonderful human being in the world. Smart, oh my gosh, what a great girl. And she was a party waiting to happen. She'd say, I'm having a few people over. I said, oh, really? Who's coming? I don't know, whoever comes. And the place would be full of philosophers and musicians and poets and narcissist, oh my gosh, it was professor. It was wild, the people who would show up there, you know. And one day she stepped off of a curb and a Volkswagen bus ran her down and killed her.
Mm.
And when that happened, I quit living. And I went straight into the bottle. And I stayed drunk for 2 years.
Wow.
You know, I'm sure I was trying really, really hard to kill myself. You think... You know, somebody says, suicide is just a guy shaking his fist at the world. You know, no, it's not. It's a person in so much pain they can't stand it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they think to themselves, if I could just get out of this life, it would be over. Or if I could just relieve my parents and my friends and my family from all the pain that I've created in this world, I'll just let it go. I'll just get out of here, you know, without any real realization what that does to people.
Yeah. That's,
you know,
definitely
like that.
the sequelae for years to come when somebody gets to that level of pain and depression and decides to commit suicide is a tragedy for all of us.
Sure, sure. You know, if I can look at my anxiety as a messenger, my anxiety and my depression both are messengers. They're here to tell me something. And if I just keep pushing it away and hiding in the closet, all they're going to do is go in that closet, make friends with rage, and come back out and get all over me and all over everybody else. Rage at myself quite often gets turned into suicide.
Right.
Rage at myself and others turns into broken relationships, injured and damaged children, divorce, abandonment. And those kinds of things. If I can look at my anxiety and my depression as a messenger, stop long enough to say, okay, you're a messenger. What is it that you're trying to tell me?
Mm-hmm.
Then I've got a chance. And some people can't do that alone. I recognize that. That's the reason I'm in the business.
Right.
I mean, you know, sometimes people have to have somebody to be able to say, wait, stop, listen to what you just said. Why did you say that? What's that about? Say it again. Let's hear it. Do it again. Good. What do you think? Good. Good. Now you're getting it. You know, some people just need that kind of help. Some people can't do that outside of a group.
Right. Or like some of the clients that I've seen have been like, okay, let me tell you parts of my life story, and I've never told anybody this before. I mean, there's so much shame and guilt and depression and anger. There's so much internal combustion going on within that person, and then they start letting that out. And it is really good to have somebody on the other end saying, hey, listen to what you just said about yourself. Did you hear you?
Really? Sometimes, and I get people in here sometimes who will come into my office and sit down and tell me basically where they came from, where they live, got their phone number and their address, and if they're insured or not, and so forth and so on. And we talk about a little bit of the process. I try to get a little bit out of them as in terms of what their problem is that we're going to focus on. They go away, come back the next week, and they say, you know, last week was so helpful to me. And I go, really? We didn't do anything but just gather information. What is so helpful about coming into therapy? Because I sat across from them and didn't interrupt them and I heard them.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, for the very first time in their lives, have somebody that's listening.
Yes, and not minimizing their problems or telling them that that they're too busy to hear somebody else's problems because their problems are bigger than the person that's trying to, you know, say, hey, listen to me. I need you to just recognize that I'm going through a difficult time right now, and if you would just take a moment to listen to me, this could make all the difference in the world.
Sure, isn't that like, it's kind of like junior high, right? Well, my mother and my father are really terrible, and they beat me and stuff, and the next kid says, well, you think that's bad? Listen to me. What happened to me? And, you know, and somebody else says, well, you think that's bad? You know, it just goes on and on and on. Monty Python did this whole thing with these old men sitting around drinking their toddy in their club, and one of them said, I sure had it hard as a child, and the other one said, oh, you think you had it hard? Well, I grew up in a home with dirt floors. And he said, well, it's a good thing you had a roof over your head. We didn't even have a roof. And they went around the room doing this ain't it awful thing.
Yeah, we love finally, Monty Python.
Finally humped and finished their toddies, you know, these five or six rich old guys, you know.
Right.
Coldstream Guard guys, you know. But they're parroting what we tend to do. We tend to one-up each other. And in the one-upping of somebody, if you do that, you don't hear them. And some people have never been listened to in their lives.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why they end up in therapy with us.
No, that's right. And that's the reason. And then anxieties come flowing out of all that.
Yes.
And depression.
Yes. Because it all feeds off of each other, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. It does.
I would like to reach out to the listeners right now. If you would like to call and add to our discussion or ask some questions of Wayne Brazil, our number is 800-893-9562. Again, that's 800-893-9562. And if later on you'd like to download this, we are on iTunes. All you do is type in Psych 1-on-1, and that's PSYCH. The number 1-O-N and another number 1. So give us a call if you'd like to join us or if you have any questions or concerns. Now, Wayne, can you go through some of the different types of anxieties that are out there nowadays?
Well, I think the anxiety in two phases, two kinds. One is what we would call generalized anxiety, and the other is specific. Specific anxiety would be I'm out of work and I'm fearful I can't pay my bills. That's very specific. These even come out as phobias. I am afraid of spiders. I'm afraid of snakes. I'm afraid of bugs. I'm afraid of things that fly and might stick to me. I'm afraid of and so on and so on. And these can even develop into obsessive compulsive behaviors to deal with those phobic kinds of feelings. You know, I've forgotten to lock the door. I can't go to sleep until I make sure that these things are taken care of. And then you've then complicated because you say, well, maybe I didn't take care of it quite. And now I've got to go back and check and make sure that I did. This constant checking over and over and over again. That those kinds of of specific kinds of anxieties. This generalized anxiety is a more of a free-floating anxiety. Oh, by the way, post-traumatic stress disorder falls in that specific anxiety, even though it seems like for some people that they don't know what the genesis for the anxiety in the first place was. I'm with Quarter Blue because my wife was a victim of childhood molestation. But she was nearly 50 when she recognized that she was molested. She had all the behaviors, but did not have the memory. And when that memory came upon her, it just flooded her. And so as a consequence of that, that was a specific anxiety, but it had become generalized. A generalized anxiety is something that has moved from the thing that happened into a more general form. So we think of things like agoraphobia. That agoraphobia, you think, well, that's a fear of being outside. But that is a anxiety that started specifically a fear of being lost or a fear of being abandoned, then can turn into, I am safer when I'm inside and I don't go outside at all. And those kinds of fears generalize. Got a young lady who was fearful of escalators and elevators. And the fear of being in the elevator and having the doors not open got to the point where she couldn't even get in a car with the doors closed. And, of course, flying in airplanes was totally out of the question. And yet she was working in a job which was requiring her to go out and to meet people and to be in business situations and in sometimes big buildings where she'd have to get somebody to help her walk the stairs. Well, you get in a 50-story building, and I'll tell you what, that's one long walk. And people don't want to do that with your hotels where you have to get concierge or somebody to take you upstairs because you can't ride in the elevator. And so as that fear of being in closed places began to get generalized, it finally got to the place where she had to quit her job because she couldn't go and be in those environments. And see, so it became kind of generalized. Other kinds of those kinds of anxieties are just, you can't locate them. You don't know why you feel this way. We do know now that that some families have anxiety as a familial kind of almost genetic base. And so we're beginning to understand a lot more about it. As we do a better job of understanding the brain and brain function, we begin to see that people can have this generalized anxiety that just kind of floods them all of the time. They live anxious from birth on. And it becomes generalized. So they're anxious about one thing specifically and maybe everything else too.
Right. And then you figure that if they grew up in a household where somebody has a lot of fears and phobias, that's going to be modeled to them. So they might have the genetic predisposition to be locking into that in their brains and their cellular systems, and then they have mom and or dad modeling it on top of it. That could be a really tough case to work with. Have you worked with people like that have really long-term anxiety problems that it's taken you a while to kind of unravel that mystery that's going on?
Sure. Oh, yes. In fact, the woman I was talking to you about not being able to get in a car and drive had finally quit her job. When we got into the family system and looked at the family, her family is full of anxiety, just full of anxiety. Her mother was one of seven girls. Father was an alcoholic, was constantly either beating the family up, various members of the family up, and he'd be drunk. They'd have to, her own mother tells stories of going and getting dad out of the bar and bringing him home. Fine. Irish Catholic family with all these kids, seven or eight kids, and so on, who are living in this incredibly anxiety-producing way. I would say probably dad was anxious. Mm-hmm. He was drinking from his anxiety. But the trouble is that when you get back beyond dad, you lose track of how many other family members are anxious. But But as we began to deal with the family, the bigger family, the overarching family of this girl, her mother, several of her aunts lived very, and the one brother was extremely anxious. It was as though this was a family pattern. And, you know, it's really hard to deal with some of that, you know, from a standpoint of psychotherapy, until we can really get a hold of what this is. And, you know, sometimes we just got to go to medicine to be able to help them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not a great fan of medicine, even though I teach psychopharmacology. I'm not a great fan of it because it seems to me like if I treat the person with medicines, when we remove the medication, we're right back. We got the symptoms back.
Right, and then on top of it, you might have the side effects of the medication to deal with also. So that's
totally.
It's, you know, I'm kind of on the fence on the psychiatric medications also, because I've spent a lot of years in the medical field and seen firsthand what can, you know, some positive effects with psychiatric medications, and then the negative effects, and it's so hit and miss with everybody.
Well, I tell my psychopharm class, you know, we're idiosyncratic. I want them to get that word in their mind and in their memory so that they can remember that we as human beings are idiosyncratic, meaning we're the same but different.
Mm-hmm.
We're all the same but different, or different but the same. So a medicine that may work for you is maybe not work for me. I know I can't take Prozac. It makes me really, really jumpy and nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute, it's supposed to calm me down. It doesn't. I know I can't take some of the painkillers, Percocet, those kinds of things make me psychotic. My last venture with that was because I broke some ribs. They gave me some Vicodin. And I took the Vicodin to help me with the pain, and suddenly I'm talking to a Jack Russell Terrier who is saying the most brilliant things in the world. He keeps jumping up and saying these wonderful things, and it suddenly dawned on me, I'm talking to a dog. This medication has made me psychotic.
Yeah, and it's too bad he didn't have a camera at that time, too, right? I mean, it could
really,
have been. It's
really
too bad. That,
but, you know, I want to be realistic about this thing.
Right.
I've got a little girl who is threatening to kill herself. She is hearing voices that are talking to her. This voice is not her own. It's a boy in her head who's older. He's 15, and he tells her things like, that girl over there likes you. Hit her and make her bleed. And, you know, and to stick a knife in her stomach and push it into her heart and murder herself. I mean, that's what she says, and I'm going, oh, my word. You know, there's only one place we can go with that. I can mm-hmm. do talk therapy with her all day, but she's got to have some medication
right.
to shut that voice, to shut those voices off.
Yeah. And
so even though I'm not a great fan of medicines, I'm going to medicate bipolar disorder.
Right.
I'm going to medicate psychosis. And the little girl that I was talking about who couldn't get into cars and had to quit her job, little girl, she's a woman, you know, what we did is we gave her a Xanax, and then we had her just carry it in her purse.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, if you carry that kind of pill in your purse, you better bring this prescription with you. Because if you ever get stopped and they search you, they're going to say, what is this? And you'll end up in jail.
Hmm.
So, but anyway, to carry a copy of the prescription with her and the Xanax wrapped up in it, and don't take it unless she absolutely needs it. Did you know that stopped the behaviors?
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Simply the knowledge that she had the medication with her.
Right.
In case she needed it. She is now working in a very important job. She lives in Houston, and she flies on airplanes and goes everywhere and does her thing, and she's very successful. And it has stopped the behavior because she knows she has the medication if she needs it.
Right. Right. So that's a medication success story, which is wonderful. And I know they are out there. Otherwise, they wouldn't, you know, keep on putting the medication out there.
I think it's criminal if you've got an ADHD child, and this means that he's actually been diagnosed by somebody who knows how to do that. He's taken a TOVA, and he's taken a Connors, and he's taken a EEG, and a neurologist has said, yes, he has this disorder. I think it's criminal not to give that child medication to help him cope.
Right, and that's one of those conditions that is really helped with medication, period, from what the research has shown.
Every day that child is sent to school where he fails. Now, you talk about anxiety-producing.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to go to school where people are going to look at him as though he's crazy, dumb, or stupid.
Right. And that's not a way to succeed at all. I mean, and to talk about causing some other problems. Exactly. So what techniques overall, like it's your toolbox, basically, of working with anxiety and depression. What are your, you know, good techniques to be dealing with those issues?
Well, first of all, I think a good clinician really, really helps. We know that psychotherapy is very, very, in our word, efficacious. It really works. In fact, we know that for depression, psychotherapy is as effective as medicine. And sometimes psychotherapy alone is better than medication. So you know, those are clinical trials. We know that to be true. So I think psychotherapy is really good. I think having a good support group is really, really good also.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, whether it's a Bible study or a church group or a psych group of some kind, or growth group, a club, people that really can stand beside you and are not going to criticize you and blame you, you know, not going to look at you like you're something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
That's really helpful. I like exercise. It's amazing what exercise will do for us when we're anxious. Working some of that off, because what we're going to do is we're going to bleed off some of those chemicals that are flooding our brain by working off that adrenaline and that cortisol and getting that feel-good chemical, that serotonin, to come full into our brain and to kind of bathe us with good feelings. So those things are good. I like journaling. I'm a great fan of journaling. To be able to put on paper the way I'm feeling at any one time so that I don't have to carry it around in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I do that with dreams. If I'm waking up in the middle of the night and can't sleep, something just keeps bugging me and nagging at me and nagging at me and nagging at me. It's my brain saying, I know what you'll do. The minute your feet hit the floor in the morning, you'll forget this really important thing. And so what you do is you keep a piece of paper and a pencil by your bed. If you wake up in the middle of the night trying to avoid thinking about something or something is bugging you, write it down. You can get it up. You can get up in the morning and there it'll be. You don't have to carry it in your head as though you're going to forget it.
Right.
So that's really helpful.
That's a safe way of letting that go. And if you need to hide it from whoever, just put it in a safe place when you get done with it.
Sure.
So maybe
sometimes I think that a low dose of Zoloft or Prozac or one of those antidepressants is really good. And there's a couple of them that are even good, like Paxil and Wellbutrin, which are good for anxiety and what I call agitated depression, anxiety-driven depression. And some of those really, really help.
Mm-hmm.
At least for a temporary stop so that we can begin to get our head straight, and then we can go on and we can move off of those things. I mean, there's some really good ones out there today. And I'm not suggesting zoning yourself out on medication, but I am suggesting we've got to stop so we can begin to think straight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
There are some techniques in therapy itself I like. I like hypnosis, and I like eye movement desensitization and reprocessing called EMDR. If somebody wanted to look that up, they could find out what EMDR means.
Yeah.
I am also, the kind of therapy I do is called internal family systems. And basically what that does is says, if you have a feeling, and I said this before, that is a negative feeling, don't push it away and lock it away. I say embrace it. Bring it closer.
Mm-hmm.
I want to treat my feelings not in a... I say I want to treat my feelings more like a sport judo relationship rather than a karate relationship. A karate relationship is, you know, you jump up and kick it in the throat and drive it away, disable it. A sport judo is you grab it and you pull it toward you using the momentum and a little leverage and get it on the ground and hold it down. See what it has to say to you. Find that out. And I think that's really, really helpful for us to say, wait a minute, I'm anxious right now. Oh, hi. How are you, anxiety? Welcome. Tell me what it is you want me to do. We need our anxieties.
Right.
I mean, my anxiety causes me to slow down. I got a car that'll drive 150 miles an hour on a freeway. Thank goodness for my anxiety. He says, for Pete's sake, man, what, are you crazy?
Unless you're driving the Autobahn in Germany, then it's a different experience.
Then it's a different story. Or out on a track at Taylor or something. You know, you
right,
can do that.
Right.
But those cars
in the appropriate situations.
My car's not.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So I look at that and I say, these things are important to me to know. It's the anxiety that causes me to study for the test.
It moves you forward.
Thank you so much for reminding me to be anxious about this.
Yeah, it moves you forward. It gets you out of bed. And you're right. I mean, you need to look at anxiety and depressions, not as enemies, but as friends. What are you
trying to tell you something?
Exactly. What are you trying to tell me? What do I need to stop and look at right at this moment? Why isn't what I'm doing right now working and causing me this much strife?
But the thing I don't want to do is to allow my anxiety to run my life.
Right.
You know, I don't give you, simply because you've got something important to say to me, I don't give you the keys to my car.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't give you the keys, you know, to my life.
Exactly.
No.
Yeah. So
you don't get to run the show. You just get to tell me what's going on.
Yeah, you get to poke me every once in a while and get me to wake up, right?
Rod me and poke me, don't run my life.
Yeah. Now, as we're wrapping up, can you let the listeners know how to contact you?
Oh, certainly. You can go to our website, Pacific Coast Psychological Associates.com, and we'd be glad to talk with you and to meet with you. And I do have a phone number. You don't mind if I give that? It's 714-992-4240. Extension 113. So you can call my office and leave a message for me, and I will get back to you.
Yeah, and it's confidential, by the way. And
you bet.
I want to strive that all of the clinicians that I have on this show, if you contact them, it is confidential. That is your right as a healthcare consumer. So don't feel like you can't be talking out and reaching out for people because you're going to be, you know, because of certain situations. This is confidential. And if this is really important to you, it's important to us also that you get the support and the help that you need when you need it.
Absolutely. And if North Orange County is too far away for you to come, you call us anyway and we'll give you a resource in your area, that's for sure.
Right, and there are so many resources out there right now for people to go and research.
Yeah.
And I also strive that there's a Psychology Today website that a lot of practitioners go to. You can look up their bios. You can look up what kind of therapy that they specialize in. You can contact the clinicians and talk to them for some of the ones you can talk to for like a minute or two and see if you're going to be getting a good connection and a good feeling from that person, because it's really important. If you go to the therapy, that can be one of the most important relationships you have in your life for the time to get you through the rough spots.
Absolutely, and that's really important to know. If you don't connect, for goodness sake, don't give up. Call somebody else.
Right.
You know.
Right, and find something to do in the moment. Do the deep breathing. Do the slowing down. Just stop yourself before you blow up or you do something that you are going to regret later, and may have dire consequences.
Absolutely.
So would you like to say anything else as we're wrapping up here, Wayne?
Oh, no, I just appreciate always the opportunity to talk about these things. It is a passion of my life to help people to cope better and to find better coping mechanisms, you know, things that really work and that don't destroy our lives. You know, so it's really a joy. I just appreciate so much the opportunity to share with you today.
Thank you, Wayne. It's beautiful that we have people like you out there and helping others. It is so important nowadays. So that's awesome. So thank you very much, Wayne Brazil, for being a guest and for talking about anxiety and depression. I'd like to thank all of our listeners. And we are on live Monday from 7 to 8 p.m. usually. So tune into us. And there's a lot of archived information that we have. We have about 10 shows in the can right now. So go back and see what really speaks to you. This is Julianne Good for Psych 101. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. Bye-bye.